Okay, yes, the evening entertainment session. Sometimes that when we have the questions, some of them are serious, some aren't so serious. You don't always have to be serious as a meditator. Sometimes a little fun, sometimes energizes the mind, it gets rid of some of the difficulties one has gone through during the day, and it's just enlivened you. And some of the questions can be very profound also. So let's see what we have here. Dear Ajahn, the loving kindness chant that we recite every evening. There is one sentence which I found very interesting and wonder why the Buddha included this sentence as part of the loving kindness. Now, one thing I always like about that is be able and upright, especially at 4:30 in the morning. Most of you are horizontal, never mind. Anyway, the phrase they wanted as part of loving kindness is, let none deceive another. Thank you, yeah, because that's just being kind. Now, one thing which you notice that when you keep that fourth precept of honesty, it also means you're very trustworthy. If you promise to do something, you'll do it. And that's such a wonderful thing to be trustworthy. And obviously, because you know, I've been keeping those precepts a long time, even as a lay person, when I was over in the monastery in Thailand for the first few years, that my friend came to visit. And that particular friend who came to visit, I think I mentioned him the other day because I grew up with him. And when he came to visit, the first day I told him the routine. I said, one of the most lovely times in the monastery, in the monastic routine, is the early morning when we go on alms round. We go on alms round in Thailand, maybe about sort of 5:45, maybe 6:15, sometimes depending on the time of the year. I said, do you want to come with us? Because it's okay being a lay person just to follow around. And we walk through the village on the early morning, just after dawn, and people come out and put food in your monk's bowl. And it's a delightful event, you know, not to be missed. But he said, look, I've only just arrived. I won't be able to get up that time in the morning. At least I can't trust myself to get up. And I told him, never mind, I'll go to your room and I'll knock on your door, I'll wake you up about 5 or 10 minutes before we need to go on alms round. And he said, thank you very much, please do that. And I did that the following morning, and we went on alms round, and on the way back from the alms round, he said it was a very strange feeling that night, because you told me that you would come and knock on my door at sort of 5:45, and I knew you would do it. He said, I come from London. And usually when people say those things, you don't know whether they're going to do it or not. He said, this was an amazing time that I knew you would do it because you're a monk and you're absolutely trustworthy. And I always remember him saying that because I take trust for granted. But there, you know, in the world which maybe some of you live in, depending on how many good Dharma practitioners you hang out with, but sometimes you can't trust people. And because of that, life gets very difficult. And so we do deceive each other sometimes. And people deceive you. And that creates a lot of suffering in this world. When you don't deceive each other, and then life is just so wonderful, so peaceful, so easy. You don't have to spend so much time worrying, will he do this? Will she do that? Because you know that you're trustworthy. And you'll try your very best to do it. If it doesn't happen, there must be some compelling reason why you didn't sort of knock on the door. Something you just could not avoid. So it's wonderful just living in a world where sort of deceit is, you know, hardly exists in like a monastery. Obviously when, you know, you do some building work and you've got the tradespeople, then there's heaps of deceit. Every time they say, the concrete's coming tomorrow. I used to, you know, because I used to order the concrete, I used to ring them up. And say, you know, it's supposed to be here 30 minutes ago, it's just left the yard. And I'd ring them up another 30 minutes, and I get somebody else, and say, oh, it's just left the yard. I say, ha, caught you. You said that 30 minutes ago. Sometimes you do catch people out, and you laugh, and they laugh, because they know that you've caught them lying. That's what they always say, just left the yard. The check's in the mail, all these other deceiving things, which we keep on saying. But it's wonderful when we don't have to do those things. We don't deceive one another. And of course, if you deceive other people, you'll deceive yourself. And of course, if you deceive yourself, and you fantasize your dream and you make your meditation much better than it really is. And of course that's no way to go. Honesty is always really, really important as a foundation of the growth in wisdom. If you can't be honest, you know, whatever you see, whatever comes up, how can you trust it? So you have to be really honest first of all. That's why in retreats such as this, you know, that as a teacher of this retreat, we never criticize. And even today, one of you came in and said, oh, I'm having a terrible day. And I said, well done. Because I don't even criticize. If you're having a terrible day, I don't say, you stupid meditator. But I've been really working hard for you. Don't you know how many talks I've given for you and how much hardness? Now, I sort of really struggle hard to teach you people, and then you just come back and you do this to me and you say, a terrible day. What are you doing? I can't do things like that. Because it's just, you know, making people feel more guilty. And because of that, sort of, you know, people don't need to deceive me back. And one of the other sort of meditators said they went in one of these Vipassana retreats or something. And they said, have you been watching your breath? Have you been watching your breath? They hadn't. But they're too scared to admit it. And that's terrible, isn't it, when sort of because the teacher is so fierce, it encourages deceit. So it's wonderful. You have to be compassionate to encourage honesty. And honesty is born in the soil of compassion. So compassion and kindness come first. And then honesty comes next. So if you're kind to yourself, you find you'll be more honest. If you're more forgiving to others, there'll be more honest back to you. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you said that if you completely let go at the time of death, then you will nirvana. But surely to have reached that point you will have already attained at least dream entry. I can't imagine not craving further existence at the time of my death. Even if I meant a crappy rebirth, which is probably on the cards in my case. Please comment. I mean, that crappy rebirth, that's, you know, that idea of a worm in a pile of dung. You can't get more crappy than that. It's like a dung beetle. However, sort of, it's actually understanding just the opportunities for nirvana almost at any moment. And some of these stories, which they have in the commentaries and the suttas, are some of the most unlikely people, you know, getting enlightened. The one which comes to mind, this was a story in some of the commentaries. It's a weird story, but it's one of these cases where the Buddha smiled. And he was walking with his attendant Ananda, and they were just, I forget where they were, but they passed the general who had actually just won a major victory. And as a reward, the king had said, no, you can actually enjoy all the pleasures, you know, of a king for 7 days. You know, enjoy yourself, you've won a great victory for me. And so he said, well, you know, you want the parties, you want the girls, you want the music, you want the drink, the alcohol. And he said, but, you know, one of the things I always wanted is a special dance, you know, which, you know, only this one girl in the whole sort of kingdom can do. It's a really special dance. Can you get her to do that for me? And to do that dance, the girl had to fast for 7 days. And he said, at the end of 7 days, she'll do this amazing erotic dance for you. I don't know what it was. And so he was carousing and getting drunk and enjoying himself for 7 days. And the reason the Buddha smiled, said, have a look what happens in 7 days. And then when it got to the finale, what he was really looking forward to, this erotic dance by this girl, she had fasted for 7 days. She started the dance, it was really nice. But then maybe because she had fasted, she dropped down dead. And because she died so suddenly, this general who just, and I don't know, been responsible for, I don't know how many deaths, and had been drunk for the last 6 days or 7 days. He was so shocked that his drunkenness completely disappeared. He came so sober and he reflected on the death and he became fully enlightened right at that moment. And then he contemplated, sort of, you know, from the point of view of being this incredibly fast arahat, sort of, I'm not going to be too old really to become a monk, and anyway, there's not much point. So he rose up into the air, self-immolated, and that was the end of him. And that was a really weird way of going. But that was one case about somebody who actually just became enlightened, most unexpectedly. Just something happened. Now, the desire, the expectation, the sudden death, you just had an avalanche of wisdom coming through and became enlightened just so quickly. So, sometimes it is as if, you know, the avalanche of wisdom is like this heap of snow on a peak, and just the smallest of triggers sometimes is all it takes, you know, to get this enlightenment experience happening. Sure, that most people go the normal way, you know, stream winning and once returning, non-returning and full arahat. But sometimes, you know, all this karma just builds up and suddenly something happens which really shocks you to the core and completely stops you thinking in your old way, and you start to see it in a new way. So you never know how close you are. In fact, you know, to my monks over in Serpentine, I've sometimes given the simile, and it's an accurate simile, that, you know, they have the idea of, this is a Buddha simile, and I'm going to adapt it. They have to say that you're on this side of the shore, which is dangerous, full of defilements, full of suffering. And the job of becoming an arahat, fully enlightened, is to cross to the further shore, where it's safe. And the thing is, this barrier of water which you have to cross over. And the Buddha's given many similes, like the simile of the raft, you know, to cross over from this side to that side. And that raft is the Eightfold Path, you know, the practice which we do. But I adapted that simile. I said that, you know, in our search for enlightenment, sometimes we walk up and down this river, trying to find a way across, up and down, always parallel to the bank. And the reason we don't cross is we're going the wrong direction. It's not up or down, it's perpendicular. I mean, just the idea of getting perpendicular, another way of doing things, not the usual way of going up by going down, but something different you've never tried before because you've never even contemplated such a possibility existed. And then you just jump over the river. One step sometimes, if you go the correct direction. Because the river isn't that wide. Now this is might sound weird to you, but the reason is you've got to find just how I can turn in that correct direction, that perpendicular direction. And I've given you heaps and heaps of clues. Letting go. Stopping this doing business. Don't practice from the standpoint of the self. But that's such a difficult thing to do. Because you've been motivated, all your actions, speech, thoughts have always been motivated by the self. You don't know anything else. So it was going up and down, parallel to the river. Now, up and down, years and years and years, trying to find a way across. Lifetime after lifetime. Somebody says, stop, look in that direction, and over you go. So sometimes that's what happens. Just a change of attitude, a little bit of right view, which is really what the streamlining is all about. And then suddenly you just jump over straight away. So sometimes the streamlining, just, you know, and the once returning, non-returning arahat, sometimes it happens all at once. So, there is hope for you yet. So this is actually one of the things, letting go. You know, when you let go, you're not doing anything, that actually stops the sense of self. It undermines it. Because every time you do something, you crave something, you choose something, you actually make the sense of self more solid. And every time you let go, the sense of self actually starts to disappear more and more. And that's why that when a person does a lot of meditating, now I'm not talking about, you know, the craving meditations where you do things and you make it happen. But when you really do this type of meditation I've been teaching the last few days here, the contentment, loving kindness, letting go, making peace with things, you're weakening your sense of self. You've nothing to do, so there's no point in you being here. I'm not talking about physically, I'm talking mentally, emotionally. And you just start to fade away. And that means that it's much easier when you die for you to fade away completely by not doing anything, by making everything so still. This is actually straight from the words of the Buddha, and this is a great little saying. So whenever there is a self, there is something which belongs to a self, its possessions. Whenever there's possessions, there is an owner, the self. And by letting go, you're actually giving up all your possessions. By letting go of the doing, you're actually letting go
of the doer. The self is going. Without a self, there's no rebirth. So that's a very quick way. Remember that when you die. And then, maybe it'll be your last life. But do you want it to be the last life? A lot of people say, no, I don't want to go. I worked so hard for enlightenment. All this pain and suffering of aching knees and getting up early in the morning, all this pain and suffering, all this sacrifice which I did, and now I've got enlightenment, I can't enjoy it. Oh, and this is another lifetime. So a lot of people, the reason people don't get enlightened is because they don't want to. Do you really want to get enlightened? It's a big question. Any comments about that before I go on to the next question? Who's got questions? Yeah.
About letting go and those things, including that's the way to go. But in terms of moving from an idea to a feeling state of letting go, we would be talking about doing stuff with meditation. Is there some practices one should not?
Are you saying the techniques to actually to try and increase the probability that you'll do that type of practice at the time when you die? And the only practice is to get the very deep and still meditations. So you just know how to stop. So you have to learn how to stop, you know, when you're still alive. Now to stop so much that you look at the mind and nothing is moving. Because you don't make it move. So if you learn how to stop in this life, then the chances are that you know how to stop when you die. So this is why we practice this meditation method. This is just one of its other advantages. Because, as I said, this is how you learn how to die properly. And die and have it done once and for all. By stopping. So you can actually see the way your mind keeps on moving. And even when you try and meditate, you can't stop it sometimes. And it just keeps on moving from one thought, from one thing to another. You know, from sometimes there's a sound outside, and why is it that the sounds disturb you? It's nothing to do with you. It's because we just can't leave them alone. We just go attaching to the external sounds, because something inside of it says that they're interesting, they're important, I must pay attention to this. So we can't let go of sounds. It's finding it hard to let go of the body, hard to let go of thoughts. This is what we train while we're still alive. And if you do this type of meditation and get into this very deep stillness, nimittas and jhanas, then you just know how to stop. You've trained all your meditative life in stopping, not doing things, but stopping. And then you know how to stop at the time of your death. So you don't do future lives. You do stopping, or rather you stop doing. So you stop, don't move. Then you can't go anywhere. Have you got a question? I thought you should, okay, go on.
Is it okay to bring a thing that a little framework of, let's say, a snowman, and its nature is to melt, and if it's like stop moving,
okay, look at, because Dania comes from Canada, so that's why her framework is a snowman. No one in Australia would imagine snowman. So maybe for some people you'd have to explain what a snowman is. Maybe a snowman, you've seen it in the movies anyway. Like a snowman, if it just stays still, sort of it melts away. I suppose so, that's a good one, if you just stay still at all. Everything you own, everything you are, everything you possess just melts away. Nothing left. Yeah, go on, let's do the snowman. Harder to do nothing, as you said. Gratitude is a great cause for happiness. Mr. Gratefully happy doing nothing. Oh, sorry. The other side. I've just got the end. Today's Dana offering reminded me of all the people who are supporting me on this retreat. Friends and family for doing without me, as the case may be, you, Ajahn, and all the Sangha, Bianca, follow retreatants. It inspires me to strive hard to do nothing. And as you said, gratitude is great cause for happiness. Mr. Gratefully happy doing nothing. Yeah, no, sometimes I used to reflect like that. All the people who feed me. And I think, they work very hard to feed us. You know, all the amount of food which we got this morning, and just the amount of time it took to cook that. And this was now not because, you know, you pay the money to come here. This was extra. So sometimes you think, wow, I don't want you to get into a guilt trip, but sometimes you think, wow, you know, am I really deserving of this? Now, can I just not strive harder through guilt, but just actually put that little bit more skillful, sensitive effort into meditating? Now, just, you've heard all the teachings, but actually apply them so that, you know, you're someone who really deserves that food. And that was one of the reflections which the Buddha told the monks and the nuns to do. You know, that, you know, in my practice, am I like a field of merit for all the people who support me? Because, you know, the more, if you like, you are further along the path, and the more you are streaming or once eternal and non-eternal and arahat, the more people's generosity bears greater fruit for them. It's like planting the seed sort of in sandy soil or in really deep, rich soil. Just what comes to mind is like planting a Bodhi tree here in Western Australia. It takes a long time for that Bodhi tree to actually to flower. You look at those Bodhi trees in the park opposite Nolamara. It takes a long time for them to come up. But once I went to Christmas Island and they wanted a Bodhi tree, and I took one down to Christmas Island and got all the permission to take it through customs. And that's a huge tree. Because in Christmas Island, you know, it's a little island in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and it's the only place for many sort of 100 miles or something where the birds can actually stop to roost. And so all these birds, they congregate on this island. It's the only place they can rest. And for centuries, they dropped all the bird shit on the island. So the soil is like full of phosphate. It's like natural fertilizer. And so you plant a Bodhi tree on Christmas Island, and it just grows big really quickly because the soil is so vital. And that's actually like, you know, the fields of merit when people make donations, offering, or even food. And, you know, you're not like, got a mind like Christmas Island, and just a small amount of good karma just blossoms really quickly. So that's why that, you know, I was taught as a monk, make sure that the people who are going to feed you, that they get good returns, you know, for all the hard work they do. So, you know, I say, how well am I spending my time? And that's a reflection which, you know, we're taught to do as monks. So we're not lazy, because it's not my food I'm eating. It's people expect something from me, and from the monks and the nuns. Without getting into the guilt trips, it just motivates you to sort of go deeper. And not be so sort of lazy. And in a sense, you know, you are part of this, on this retreat. People came to feed you. So don't waste time thinking about stupid thoughts. You know, out of gratitude for the people who have fed you today. And all the people looking after you. See if you can just motivate yourself. Just go a little bit deeper in your meditation. Be a little bit more skillful, a little bit more wise, a little bit more compassionate and kind. And then, their food would have done the job. So it's just an encouragement. How does one know one has attained enlightenment? Is there sort of a litmus test for it? Do people of other faith ever get enlightened? Thanks. If you ask that question, you do not know what enlightenment is. So you can't be. Anyone who says, am I enlightened, obviously isn't enlightened. Because actually, this is standard teachings of the Buddha. That after enlightenment comes the knowledge of enlightenment. It has to come. There's no such thing as you're enlightened and you don't know it. You know, if you are, you know. And how do you know that one has attained enlightenment? It's usually because, you know, first of all, the stream winning is one of the easiest to know, because actually you see just, you know, the non-self. You know, you see just how the mind works and how it's truly empty. And the inside is incredibly strong. And also, you know, sort of many defilements, so
sort of not there anymore. You don't get angry if you're sort of a non-returner. And that's always the case. We always try, if somebody comes along and says they're a non-returner or fully enlightened, the test is always to try and make them angry. And it's usually pretty easy to get people to get angry. You know, you're stupid, Pauline. Look at the way you're sitting there. No, you can be offensive, because I don't mean that. It's very obviously, you know, that you may be right because you did get upset at me back, so you were laughing. That's a good tick there, Pauline. You got promise. But you know I was only messing around. But this is actually what you should do, because as Westerners, in our culture, we're very skilled at offending people. We know how to do it really, really well. We've had a lot of practice. So it's usually pretty easy to try and make someone angry. And if they do get angry, respond back, obviously, that means they're not enlightened. So this is actually how we usually test people out, to see if they get angry. Because lust is sort of inside, so it's very hard to see, but angry is very, very easy to see in the face of another person, in their demeanour, in their speech. If you get angry, you've blown it. So you're not enlightened yet. If you get, afraid. I don't know, you know all my stories, but I can't help but say that story about when I thought I was enlightened, when I became enlightened. That was just such a interesting, it was funny at the time. Funny afterwards, but not at the time. I was really disappointed and depressed. Because my fourth year as a monk, I always really had good meditation. And I found a nice quiet monastery and I was really doing good meditation. It's very, very simple, nothing much going on. But the thing which is an important part of the story was the food in the monastery was disgusting, like most of the food in northeast Thailand. The food was usually standard every day the same, which was rotten fish curry. We had our sticky rice, and rotten fish curry was, they catch the fish in the paddy fields during the wet season, and they'd store them, and that was the protein for the rest of the year. And so that this was the beginning of the rainy season, so they're still using the fish when they're 1 year old. And the way they were stored, it wasn't hygienic. The story I usually tell was in one of our monasteries, I was cleaning up around the kitchen, because the monks look after the monastery. We clean up, especially in Thailand. We're not lazy at all. We'd actually do work, make sure everything is nice and tidy. And I found this jar of rotten fish. Which all they did was shove it in the jar and put a piece of plastic and a rubber band over the top, just to protect it from the flies or anything else. But this rubber band had either sort of got rotted away and got loose because a fly got in there and laid all the maggots inside the fish. So you can see the rotten fish in there. You could also see all these maggots crawling all over it. So I picked it up and went to throw it away. And at that time, the headman of the village was visiting, and he was the most refined and educated. That's why he became the headman of the village. And he saw me with this jar and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Look, the flies have got into it. It's crawling with maggots. I've got to throw it away." And he got very upset. He said, "You can't throw that away. Give it to me. More protein." And next day we had rotten fish curry. Now that was actually, the sort of disgusting stuff. And there's many other stories, I'm sure you've heard of all, about the disgusting things we used to eat. And it wasn't just disgusting to look at and to contemplate, it actually tasted disgusting too. It stank. But that was all you had. Maybe a few bamboo shoots, whatever else was there at the time. And so that was the usual, the stinky bamboo and rotten fish curry. That night before, I had some really nice meditation. And it was walking meditation, sitting meditation. There are times you get really hot in meditation. You're so peaceful, it's so easy to meditate. It gets very, very still. And you come out afterwards, you walk meditation. And just insights, they just come. And they're really deep ones. And I was walking along there, and all these incredible insights were coming. And I was just getting really blown away by all this Dhamma, which was becoming so clear to me. And of course, you weren't asleep at this time, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, who cares, because you've got so much energy. I was walking on the path there, and that was when the big one came.
amazing, this deep insight into the nature of the mind. And when that happened, it was almost like crying, jumping up and down. It's enlightenment, at last, after 4 years of hard work. And it's an amazing feeling, you know, when you're enlightened. My problem was it never lasted that long. Because it wasn't the real thing, that's why I say it. Because if you really are enlightened, you never tell anybody. So it was a forced enlightenment, but it really felt good at the time. And it had all the signs, everything you'd expect of being enlightened. Just incredible energy, deep understanding of what was going on, and absolutely no tiredness whatsoever. And it was about 1 o'clock or 1:30 or something. I decided, you know, I should go to my room just to lay down, have a little bit of a sleep. But you lay down, you don't go to sleep, you're just laying down and just really blissed out, nice and peaceful. So the bell goes at 3 o'clock in the morning. So at 2:30 I was in the hall meditating again. And usually I mentioned I had lots of sloth and torpor because of the bad diet, the hot climate, you know, humid in the sort of the rainy season, no mosquito nets, lots of mosquitoes all over the place. And so sometimes you didn't even get much sleep anyway. So it was sleep deprived, malnourished, bad climate. So I was always sleepy, but that morning, absolutely straight back. Not the tiniest bit of sleepiness. All the hindrances were banished. Just perfect meditation. And it was enlightenment. And I thought, wow, this is really good. At last. And then we went on arms round, you know, after sort of the morning meeting. Went on arms round, I was thinking, all these lucky people were giving food into my bowl because I was a huge field of merit for them. And I was zapping everybody with metta. And, you know, it's a real thing, all the sort of everything was going your way. And then I go back to the dining hall where we would have our lunch. And that's when I noticed there were 2 pots of curry that morning. And that was very strange. I hadn't had that for, you know, I don't think ever in that monastery. And I saw the pots of curry, and you could smell the rotten fish one, the usual one. The other one was a pork curry. I don't know where that came from. But that was actually special. That was, you know, delicious. That wasn't the sort of the stuff from the northeast of Thailand. This was more like from Bangkok. And it was actually, you know, edible for a Westerner. And straight away, when I saw that, I thought, yes, the Devas are celebrating my enlightenment. They decided they want to get some merit as well, so they decided to make a nice curry. Not the sort of the northeast. This is like Deva curry. So there they were, the 2 pots of curry, and you know, when we sort of gave the blessing, what we used to do there was just to pass the pots down, because only about 4 or 5 monks in this monastery. And so the abbot, you know, even though I was only 3 or 4 rains retreats, I was number 2 in the line. So the abbot, you know, he had first choice. And had one, you know, these big ladles. And I couldn't believe just how many, about 3 or 4 huge ladles of this pork curry he put into his bowl. No one could eat that much. And I'm not even the greediest of monks. But there he was, but I thought, I'm enlightened, who cares? But then what he did next was completely over the top. He was a local boy, he was actually from that village, so he was used to rotten fish curry. And he never took any himself. Instead, he took hold of the rotten fish curry, and he poured it all into the pork curry bowl and stirred it all up again and said, it's all the same anyway, it's all the same anyway. And then he passed it to me. And I thought, look, if it was all the same anyway, why did you take yours first? And 4 big scoops, you greedy pig of an abbot. And now look what you've left me. I haven't got any pork curry anymore. I've got this messed up with all this rotten fish in it. And I was just really pissed off at that muck. And that's when I realised, our hearts don't get pissed off. That's really so terrible. It was much worse than getting angry, realising you're enlightened after all. You've got to start all over again. So that was actually one experience which I had, because, you know, sometimes in meditation you just get really deep experiences and great insights. Sometimes you can even think that, yeah, that's it, you're enlightened. But it needs something like that, real life, to come and hit you. You know, that your sort of your cravings and desires for nice food, or you get fed up with stupidity. No, it was a stupid thing that Mike done. You know, he shouldn't have done that, but nevertheless, I got angry. And because I got angry, oh, that was just so disappointing. Spoiled my whole day. Spoiled the whole range retreat, really. So that's the litmus test, to know whether you're enlightened or not. Doesn't get angry, grieve, fear, all those sorts of things. Enlightened, they don't come up. Any comments or questions about that? So anyone who wants to think to enlightened, come over here. And I'm going to give you some nice food tomorrow morning. Dear Ajahn, you said that we should just ignore sounds that people make during meditation. Coughing and clearing throat is a natural thing. However, isn't there a space for people to cultivate consideration for others who are trying to come to stillness? Isn't thoughtfulness of others part of this process, not just thinking of ourselves, but of others and our environment? There can be a lack of this if an attitude of let them watch sounds, not my problem, their problem. Please elaborate. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, you know that you can't control other people. And there was this case, one of the retreats I gave, I'm missing about 15 years ago now, over in Wat Buddha Dharma in Sydney. And when we went to the retreat there, there were people, it was only like a small, well, it was maybe about the size of this hall here. And then after two or three days, someone wrote in the question box a complaint. Because one of the people was just really breathing loudly, making a huge noise. And constantly. And they said, look, can't you teach people to breathe quietly? It's really disturbing me, it's bugging me. And then my answer was, so that particular meditator, he's dying of sinus cancer. He's got a huge tumour at the top of his nose. This is his last throw of the dice to see if meditation can help him. So that's why it's making a noise. And everyone was so quiet afterwards, and no one complained again when they found out why. And they could be compassionate because they understood the cause of that noise. And again, I'm going to continue that story because the last day of the retreat which I gave, just at the end, he wanted a quick interview. And he said that last day he was meditating, and he hadn't been able to breathe through his nose, you know, for weeks. That's why he's always breathing through his mouth and making a big noise, because of the big tumour. And he said he was meditating, got quite peaceful, and he heard something go pop. And he could breathe through his nose again. And then by the end of the meditation, it closed up again. He said it was so weird. He was meditating there, and he knew he had a big tumour in his nose, and he couldn't breathe for weeks. And now for the first time in all that time, he could breathe for maybe 15 minutes through his nose before it closed up again. And the meditation was doing something for him. He had like a clear sign that that tumour must have been decreasing, you know, while he was meditating, you know, quickly, that he could actually breathe. But I thought at the time that, you know, he'd had it, it was just too late. But yeah, I saw him again in Sydney, you know, a few years ago. Now, I usually see him every year when I go to Sydney and I go and give a talk at this John Barter's place, he usually comes along. His tumour went because of his meditation. He really got it together. So he's still alive and kicking, having a wonderful time, and teaching other people some of the benefits of meditation for cancer. So sometimes if people make noise, sometimes they're trying their very best, they just can't do anything more. However, you know, you should always try and be sensitive to others. And try, and if you come in and out of this hall, as you can imagine, you're a burglar. So the burglar has to be very mindful. Because if a burglar makes any noise, it wakes up the people in the house and they get caught. So when you come into this room, you tread so quietly. So you're like a burglar and you creep up behind somebody. And you sit down on your meditation cushion and they don't even know you were there. And you can leave without them knowing either. That takes a lot of mindfulness and compassion. So why not try that? So you hardly make any noise. And even when you go to your rooms at night, you don't bang the doors. You tread very quietly. And you hardly make a noise. And no one knows you're there. You're disappearing again. Now, not only does that mean that you are helping other people and being more mindful, but if you do want a new career as a burglar, you're getting some... No, for like for the ACL or CIA or something, you know, for a good cause. No, that's not a very good thing to encourage people, but at least you're actually being more mindful. So try and be quiet. But People usually try their best, but they just can't do it. So there's always be some noise, no matter what. So because of that, just cut people a bit of slack, be compassionate to them. Once the noise happens, it just happens. So don't let the noise echo in your mind. Someone coughs, and don't start thinking, oh, they cough, why are they coughing, they shouldn't cough. We should actually, when I went to Singapore during the SARS crisis, they had these infrared detectors to see if anyone's got a fever or a cold. And if they had a fever or a cold, they could actually enter the country. So we should have that at the front gate when you come in for the meditation retreat. The infrared sensor, so anyone who's likely to get a cold, sorry, you can't come in. That's not kindness, compassion. So it even so that people get a cold while they're here. Or they take some of these, they used to say, take some Panadol or something to get your temperature down, just before you go through the scanner, and then they won't see you. There's always tricks to do. But that's not what we're really here for. So be compassionate, be kind to people who are coughing, and you be compassionate and kind to try and make minimum noise as well. That make sense? Yeah?
I live in a building at this moment where they have a lot of construction noise.
Yeah.
Simply cannot get the air together.
Well, you try and find a quiet place to meditate. That's why we have monasteries out in the bush, and forest monasteries, we don't have them in the city. So we don't plant our temples like the Burmese temple or the Thai temples. They usually plant them in the middle of the city. And very often they're in poor suburbs next to industrial areas where there's huge amounts of noise. And that's really not the nice place for a temple. You try and make it quiet areas, if at all possible. And the best of forest monasteries are outside in the bush somewhere, and it's very quiet there. And that's why the retreat centre, which I'm building right now, is out in the bush. It's quiet, so you don't have the sounds of the sirens. Or, sometimes, I think last night or the night before, there was fireworks. Which disturb people. So we try and keep it quiet as possible. You can never get it perfectly quiet. So sometimes there will be some construction noises going on in your building. But they don't last forever. At night time they usually stop. And that might be the time you can meditate. So you can listen to the TV while the building work is going on. Or do your other work. But at night time when they stop, TV off, and work stops, and then you can meditate. Or early in the mornings. Early in the morning is a wonderful time to meditate, because most people get up late, even here. So the morning time is much quieter. So it can be done, but you just got to arrange things. Hi Ajahn Brahm, thank you for being here. How do you know what is the most important thing in life? Thank you. Okay, the Emperor's Three Questions. You should have all read this in the book, Open the Door of Your Heart. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? And what's the most important thing to do? So you all read that book, I hope. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? The person you're with. Yeah. And what's the most important thing to do? Yes. Very good. 3 out of 3. A lot of you didn't know that. You forgot. You have to get a copy of the book and do your homework before you come on retreats with me. The most important thing to do is to care. Halfway between being careful and caring. Compassion and mindfulness. That's the most important thing to do. To have compassion and mindfulness. Not just to be mindful, not just to be compassionate, but join those two together. Mindfulness and compassion. The most important thing you can do. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in Australia today, sex before marriage is very common. Sometimes sex after marriage is very common too. With somebody else. Terrible. But I mean, it's true, isn't it? People today, terrible. Anyway, does this practice on its own go against the 5 precepts for lay people? And would the practice affect one's meditation practice at home more than sex would after marriage? Okay. It really depends whether it's with consenting adults. If it's not with consenting adults, you may not be married, but they are, then that's really creating a lot of difficulty and pain for other people.
But if it's with consenting adults and neither is committed to another person, they're just committed to you, then it seems to be it's no difference than sex after marriage or in marriage. So that's basically that if it's before marriage but consenting adults and they're committed to each other, so you're not sleeping with somebody else's partner, then it seems to be exactly the same as if it's in marriage. Any comments on that? I always remember Groucho Marx being interviewed. He said, "What do you think about sex?" And he says, "It's here to stay." Dear Ajahn, when you meditate, do you attain jhana every single time? And are there times when your mind keeps wandering? Ajahn, why are people wondering what I do? Wondering what you do. And anyway, there is a rule. And this is why that sometimes people, they try and ask you, Ajahn Brahm, do you really get jhanas? Are you enlightened? Can you levitate? I'm a bit too heavy these days. Can you read minds and all that sort of stuff? Now, if you doubt me this, go and look into the books. It's Paticca number 8, the 8th rule of the Paticca section. It says that monks, you should not announce to the lay community any psychic power, any level of enlightenment, or any deep meditation like a jhana. You're not supposed to say that. And that's an offence. It's one of our rules that we're not supposed to do that. And there's a reason for that. Sometimes I wonder, why is that reason? Why can't we inspire people by saying, yes, I'm enlightened now, or I can read people's minds? Why can't we just levitate and really give people a nice demonstration? And there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is the Buddha wanted the monks not to show off. And because sometimes showing off, why are you showing off anyway? Why are you telling these things? Sometimes it can be just making a stronger ego for yourself. And secondly, it actually almost separates, the community of monks and nuns between the elite, the ones who've got jhanas, the ones who are enlightened, and the riffraff, just the ordinary ones. And the first time which I realized that, and what happened, was again in Ajahn Chah's monastery, the first few weeks I was there. And again, food is disgusting, but every now and again, somebody from town, from the city, they come along and they bring some Bangkok food, and it's quite nice food. Now I'm talking about the village food, that was the disgusting stuff. And this one day, I was sitting there, and a truck comes up, a pickup truck, and full of pots and pans in the back, with dana, with food from the town. Now this wealthy man wanted to make some merit with Ajahn Chah, so he came with all his pots of food. And then he came into the dining room, and I thought, wow, we're going to get a good meal today. And his first question was, is Ajahn Chah here? He was actually eating at someone's house that day, so they said, no, he's not here. So they got in the car and went back home again. Because, it was much more merit feeding an arahat like Ajahn Chah. Feeding little monks like me, you don't get much bang for your bucks, as they say. And that would happen. People in Thailand would go searching out those monks who they thought were arahats and feed them heaps and heaps of food, give them heaps of donations. And the other monks sort of hardly got anything. And that was really unfair. It was like splitting up the sangha between the haves and the have-nots. I used to crack a little joke. If you're an enlightened one, they call them the Arya sangha. Have you heard that word before? The Aryans? That was actually a word coined by the Buddha for the enlightened ones. Stream winners, once returners, non-returners, and arahats are called the Arya sangha. So I called them the Aristocracy. These are the elite. And everyone else is just, the ordinary working class monks. And having come from a society like in England, where there was the working class and the aristocrats, I really rebelled against that. And I didn't like that. People should be judged evenly. It's just they're a monk and that's enough. And because of that, the Buddha said, look, don't tell anybody if you've got any attainments, because we want all monks to be regarded as the same by the lay people, just a monk.
So you look after all of the monks, not just the senior monks or the monks you think are especially enlightened. And also it means much greater harmony between the different monks. So that's why that we're not allowed to say. And any monk or nun who does come along and say and announces in front of everybody, I'm enlightened, or I'm a stream winner, or I have jhanas and follow me, then that's a very suspicious teacher. Instead, you just teach the Dhamma. You don't sort of say, no, this is my Dhamma. I always say, I got it from Ajahn Chah, I got it from the Buddha. So you just teach the Dhamma, you teach about jhana's enlightenment, but you don't sort of make any claims yourself. So that's why we can't answer that question. But there is a way around it. The loophole. I don't know why I'd say this loophole. The loophole is, I can tell other monks, but I can't tell you. So if you really want to know what a monk is doing, you ask, say, Venerable Santiti, what does Ajahn Brahm do? And you can ask me, Ajahn Brahm, what's Venerable Santiti up to? But usually even these days, that sometimes we don't even tell too many monks, we just keep it maybe just to our teacher or to a very close friend. Because sometimes if you start to make any claims at all and the word gets around, it just makes a lot of problems for yourself, because people actually start testing you out. I tell that Venerable Santiti, I'm an arahat, I'm fully enlightened, and he goes and I say, yes, I'm an arahat. Then you try and make me angry. Just because you heard that, that's going to test out. Is Ajahn Brahm really out to start being really nasty to me and started mixing the worst possible food, in my bowl? You make life a misery for me. So that's bad karma for you. Causing stomach aches to enlightened beings. just a test of that. That's why it's best to keep away from all of that and don't say anything. You make up your own sort of mind anyway. Well, that's very, very bad karma, and that's one of the disrobing offences for monks. If any monk goes along and they know they're telling a lie, and they say, yes, I've got jhana, yes, I'm enlightened, and they know they're lying, then actually from that time on it's the same as even sexual intercourse or killing a human being or stealing. From that moment they said that, they've lied about the table and they haven't got deliberately, then they're no longer a monk. So the Buddha was very, very severe on that particular rule. The other three disrobing offences, killing a human being, sexual intercourse, or stealing, you think, monks should not do that, they deserve to have to disrobe. But this other rule is on the same level. Any monk who falsely claims one of these attainments, even a jhana, and they falsely claim it deliberately, they haven't just made a mistake and just overestimated themselves, but they know they haven't, but they say they have, then that's disrobing. They're no longer a monk. So it's a tough one. That's why the monks be very careful. And it's best actually not to ask them, because sometimes, if you ask them, a monk sometimes, and then afterwards, they go, what have I done? I'm no longer a monk. So be kind and careful to your monks by not asking them questions. And if you do that, sometimes it's deluding. Because we have this strong rule for monks, that's why you don't hear monks going around saying these things. But I know that in some communities, some lay people go around telling that they're enlightened or they're a stream winner. And because they haven't got this rule to actually to make sure they really know what they're saying, otherwise it's disrobing, that sometimes they say it too loosely. And they do it mostly to gain disciples. And there's many lay teachers. And to gain disciples, you've got to show your qualifications. And so, I'm a stream winner, I'm a once returner, I'm a non-returner. I've met many of those, and they're not. So they think they are, but they haven't really got a clue what they're talking about. And they can deceive other people when they deceive themselves. Make sense? Okay. Here we go. This is nice. You remind me of a Dhyana joke, Ajahn Brahm. Okay, this is this evening's joke. The Pope dies and is being shown around heaven by St. Peter. He notices that the Diana has a halo, and he, the head of the Catholic Church and millions of Catholics, doesn't have a halo. Ah, yes, Your Eminence, says St. Peter, but that's not a halo, it's a steering wheel. Because he died in a car crash. Not my joke, I've got nothing to do with it. I won't say whose joke it is. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you are so happy and your happiness is infectious, but how can we meditate on the 32 parts of a human body and a decaying corpse and yet maintain that happiness? You do the 32 parts of the body, it's actually 31 parts, the commentary added the 32nd part of the brain. But in the parts of the body, hair of the head, hair of the body, mouth, teeth, skin, and all this other stuff inside, just to make sure it's just a body, that's all. It's nothing really important. You just look after it, but it's not something to celebrate or to worship or worry about having Botox injections when you leave here. Worry about sort of how you look or, you know, makeup and stuff like that. It's your body. It's going old, so let it get old. And the decaying corpse is just to say, that's going to be you. You see a corpse decaying, you know that's, you know, the nature of you. Eventually, if you don't get cremated, you decay in your box. When you decay in the box, the worms and other stuff eat it. Actually, that's one of the jokes which I heard. So actually, it's a balance or die joke. This is hypochondriac. He's always visiting the doctor. He goes to the doctor and says, oh, I've got a sore throat. It's throat cancer, isn't it? He said, no, it's not. You've just got a cold. He goes next week and sort of, oh, I've got this itch everywhere. That must be herpes. I'm going to get sort of HIV. He said, no, it's not. It's just sort of a little rash. Take some sort of cream. He's always just, you know, so hypochondriac. The slightest thing, he goes to see his doctor. So he goes in the doctor one day. And he said, doctor, there's something wrong with me. I feel really, really sick. And the doctor said, look, I've had enough with you. Just, there's nothing wrong with you. Get out of here. Stop bothering me. Get out. He's very firm with him. And so the poor man was really quite shocked. He sort of goes out in shock and he crosses the road in front of a truck and gets killed. He gets killed right there. And so the doctor hears the crash and sees outside and says, oh my goodness, I've killed this poor fellow. I've caused his death. And actually, that was such a shock to the doctor has a heart attack as well. So they go and get buried in graves alongside one another, sort of just an hour after each other. And the poor old doctor's only been in his coffin dead for about sort of 2 hours when there's a knock on his coffin. And it's the hypochondriac saying, doctor, have you got anything for worms? That's my joke. They're decaying corpses, that's just what they are, they get lots of worms. But be careful, there's a purpose for that, and that's just actually lessening lust, especially. Especially that desire for the opposite sex, or worried about how your body looks. But some people go too far, and they get so miserable, and they get almost like deviant, looking at sort of corpses or autopsies. And so some monks who do that, it's interesting, those monks who really get into like the asupa, decaying corpses and 32 parts of the body, I've noticed in my 34 years as a monk, they disrobe and get married. It's weird. But the ones who really get into the asupa practice are the ones who've got lots of lust. And usually that doesn't really overcome the lust, it suppresses it. And eventually they can't stand life as a monk, they've got no happiness. They're just more into the negative side of life. And eventually they leave and they just go and get married and live the lay life again. So that's why a super meditation or decaying corpses is okay just as an antidote if you're a very, very lustful person to try and find the middle. So you look at a person of the opposite sex, they're just a person, that's all. They're not like a sex object or something you want to sort of have pleasure with. They're just another being. So you know, treat them as another being. If you're a man, treat them like your sister. You know, if they're sort of a boy, it's like your brother, not as a sort of a potential partner. And if you do things like that, you have loving kindness to the opposite gender, but you don't have this sort of fear. I think sometimes that the asupa is a reaction to the fear of the opposite gender, or the fear of your lust. which really isn't overcoming it. The best way to overcome the lust is actually to get such a deep meditation and get the happiness better than sex. And then when you've got the choice there, sex or jhanas, no choice. You go for the happiness of meditation. Because with meditation, it has the advantage you don't have babies. And all those things to worry about when you have babies and get caught up in the world. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I did that many, many times. Go to see autopsies. On a Monday morning was the best time to go to see the autopsies because that's the time they drag the bodies from the river. We used to go to Sirirat Hospital. And now, when you really got in the know, you know to go to the best place for the best autopsies. But the first time I walked into that hospital, because you're a monk, you walk right through anywhere. And when I went into the autopsy room, I couldn't believe it. On the actual shelf, there was a plate and there was a human head on the top of it. You know, it was straight out of some sort of horror movie, but that was actually the local autopsy room in the hospital there. So, you know, watch the autopsies being done. And you know, I used to, when I was a kid, I remember in our black and white TV set, we used to have there was a show, it must have been on BBC, about, you know, your body operations. And they'd sort of have a camera and showing operations, you know, appendicitis or heart operations and stuff like that. And I used to love watching that. And my mother, my father and my brother had to leave the room. They wanted to turn on to another channel, but I said, educational, educational. That was an important word. And so, okay, go and watch it. So I loved that, even when I was a kid. So when I saw real autopsies, it wasn't a big thing at all. It was interesting. I was fascinated by the science of it more than anything else. But anyway, that after you've been through the ordinary autopsies, then you went into the special room, which is actually where they dragged the bodies from the Chaopai River on the weekend. Because, you know, it's high murder rate or people get drunk, and there's always these bodies floating in the river. And they have to give it an autopsy to make sure, you know, it hasn't been a murder. So you go in there, and there's no aircon in the room. And it's on the ceiling. There's this big sort of yellow, red sort of guck on the ceiling. And then you know why it happens, because they take this bloated corpse, and it looks like just out of the movie, like big bulging eyes and blue. You know, make a great sort of model for some horror movie. And it stinks. Because it's been rotting away. And all the sort of the worms and stuff in it, it's really gross, but not yet you get to the sort of the finale. Because there's so much gas and stuff inside there that the doctor has to pop the corpse. And he just had like a stick with a nail in the end, nothing hygienic at all. So whatever the doctor, you know, who was on duty there, he must have done something very, very bad, very naughty to have the worst job in the whole hospital of popping the corpses from the river. And he'd stand back because the nail was on a long stick and pop it and he'd get out of the room. And my, that stench was terrible and all this gut would go up on the ceiling. That was really yucky. But you know, sometimes you get into it as a man, as a monk, to try and gross people out. But it didn't do anything for you. It was just like weird and interesting, that's all. But you know, after a while, you see so many autopsies, so what? It never really sort of stopped your lust. And what does stop your lust is when you actually have more wisdom. So the negativity of just trying to imagine a girl like a corpse, she's not a corpse, she's alive. So that didn't really work to stop lust. You needed the wisdom and the peace to actually give you a calm state of mind. So that's why I didn't really really get into the autopsies and that stuff. I did it, went there, saw it, but it didn't really make much difference to me. And I can see how sometimes you can really get into it and really get almost like deviant mind states.
So, would you recommend
listeners
have got the opportunity to buy a DVD called Autopsy by a German guy?
Oh, yeah.
Go through.
Or sometimes. Sometimes should you view the autopsies? It's not that bad to view an autopsy once and just to see what it does to you. And if it doesn't actually make any doesn't do anything to you at all, means you don't need to do it. But if you get afraid,
sometimes it means that, you know, you've got a very weird idea of your own body. You think that, you know, it hasn't got all those parts in it and it won't die. So when actually you see that, you see, that is my body, it's exactly the same. That's really what it's supposed to do, so you don't have great attachment to the body, and you don't have a fantasy about what your body is. So as long as you're being realistic about your body, if you see it and it's cut up and you see all the parts of it, you realize, yeah, that's my body, it doesn't really do anything to you, you know that already, so you don't need to go anymore. But if you get afraid, especially you get fear when you go in there and think, ugh, what are you afraid of? It's only your body being cut up, big deal. So are you afraid of seeing an autopsy? If you are, then you need to go. If you really aren't afraid, it's just interesting, that's all, then you don't need to go. We don't need to see that. But no, it is a tradition. I know one story I read this in, Venerable Gunaratana's, in one of his journals. Because, you know, he was talking to his disciples about sort of autopsies, and they decided to try and go and see one in the local hospital. So they rocked up there together, and they tried to get in, but you know, there's rules and regulations. And even though they said, look, you know, we're just like sort of students, we just want to sit in the back and watch, you know, because this is part of our religious training, can we just watch the autopsy? No matter what, you know, Venerable Gunaratana said he couldn't sort of weasel his way into the autopsy room, so they all went back. But one guy decided to stay, one of his disciples, the lay disciples, who wrote the article in the newsletter. He decided to hang out then. Maybe he could see somebody and sort of wheedle his way in. And he saw one guy going in, sort of, or coming out. He started talking to him, let's have a cup of coffee together. And they had a cup of coffee in the canteen and started talking. And the reason why this guy coming out of the autopsy, he's one of the technicians there, the reason why he wanted to have a talk, he was going through a divorce with his wife and he just needed someone to talk to. He was having a lot of problems. And this disciple of Gunaratana, he was actually a lawyer. And he said, look, you know, it's really expensive, you know, actually, to do these divorces. I can actually help you, you know, for free. I can actually write out all the papers for you, if you can get me into the autopsy room. And this guy, ah, yeah, sure, shouldn't be a problem. You know, just I can get you, put you in one of the gowns. Just don't say anything, keep quiet, okay? And so they made a deal, you know, I'll do your divorce papers, you know, you get me into the autopsy room. So he snuck him into the autopsy room and, you know, put a gown on everything on him, and then when the next autopsy came, you know, he was standing around with all the doctors. Now the one thing about lawyers, they just cannot keep quiet, they cannot keep their mouth shut. And that was a big problem, because they were doing the autopsy apparently on this Afro-American who died. And they said, you know, it's a piece of work, he'd been in and out of hospital, many operations, and they want to find out what killed him. And as they were sort of, you know, opening him up and looking inside, one of them said, there it is, and he gave this Latin name. And our doctors think they know Latin and say, oh, that's cancer, said the lawyer. And everyone stopped and looked at, who are you? Because that Latin word was medical malpractice. Someone had stuffed up and killed the guy. I said, who are you? And he said, I'm a lawyer. Ah! Get out of here, quick! Because he could have sort of told the relations and sued that hospital for millions. So that's why they don't allow people to go and see autopsies. Because doctors, they make mistakes sometimes and they don't want to be found out. So that was put in this newsletter, and it was a very, very funny article. I can see a movie, but the movie's not the same as seeing it sort of live. You know, if you see it sort of a movie, you haven't got the smells, you haven't got the softness there and everything else. There's no, it's no big deal, it's just a sort of an autopsy, that's all. If you don't want to see an autopsy, just next time there's a funeral service, just go up to the corpse and touch it. And then hold it and see that that's a corpse. And that's how I'm going to be later on. So just overcoming your fear of death and the fear of sort of the body, what it really is, that's all. There's no big deal. So if it's a big deal, then you need to do something about it. But if it's no big deal, that's okay. But please don't have nightmares tonight. Last night, Ajahn, you said that most of the retreat group were on the bus to Nibbana and couldn't get off if they even wanted to. Now, what about the remaining percent who seem to have missed the bus?
You're talking about yourself. We only have the opportunity to board the bus in this lifetime. Ah, don't worry about it, because sometimes people think they're not on the bus, but they are on the bus. And don't worry about it, you'll be okay. So remember, if you're not on this bus, there's always another bus coming behind. The Ajahn Brahm in the Metta Sutta, standing or walking, seated or lying down, one should sustain this recollection. Does this mean metta meditation or be aware of what you are doing at that particular time? That means the metta meditation. So in other words, it's loving kindness to all beings, and especially loving kindness to this moment, no matter what you're doing. You can always do metta, and it always works, if you do it properly. So having loving kindness to this moment, being at peace with it, embracing it, allowing it to be. So you can't really go wrong with loving kindness. Dear Ajahn, should not Buddhist monks be vegetarian? Mahayana monks are, but Thai monks eat meat. I am confused. Please help. I have said that when, in those early years, I used to be a vegetarian before I became a monk. Then I had to eat rotten fish and frogs and what was that, buffalo afterbirth. We often thought about buffalo afterbirth, that was vegetarian. Because that never harmed any animal. Because it was just left over after the buffalo gave birth to its young, and the placenta, the afterbirth, that didn't hurt anybody. So even vegetarians should be able to eat buffalo afterbirth. Why not? It doesn't harm anyone, it's just left over stuff. Same with the vegetarians, because vegetarians eat roadkill. You know, like sort of, you know, when the cars, you know, hit sort of a bird or hit a kangaroo, it's already dead. Sure, that would be good vegetarian food, wouldn't it? Why are you vegetarian? Is it because you don't want to harm animals? If so, that roadkill should be okay for you. So now I'm asking questions of you. But no, you have to eat whatever we're given a lot of times. Sometimes you don't have choice. So it's not a big deal either way. So even the Buddha ate meat. That was very clear in the time of the Buddha. So if the Buddha ate meat, it must have been okay. And the Buddha said, like, don't make a big thing about it. And if you offered vegetarian food, have vegetarian food. If you offered meat, sometimes eat meat. I tried to be a vegetarian as a monk, you know, when Ajahn Jaka was here, but I gave up. I had one occasion, they were invited for a meal in somebody's house, and I couldn't believe what they'd given us. It was every different type of meat you could possibly imagine, and white rice. There was not a vegetable, there was not a fruit, there was not a leaf. It was chops, sausages, steaks, bacon, everything. It was just all meat, and I couldn't believe it. And you know who that lady, I'll tell you afterwards, Pauline, who it was. But you know her very, very, very well. And it was really, really embarrassing. Because, you know, fortunately I was second monk, so she was mostly watching the senior monk Ajahn Jaka at the time. And I put rice in the bowl, and I put my spoon into the meat dishes, and sort of, now, when she wasn't looking, sort of take it out again, because I wasn't putting anything in my bowl, so I just ate white rice that day, without any sort of anything else. And I realised that was the last time I gave up sort of trying to be a vegetarian. Because sometimes I have to eat what people want to give to me, not what I like. Because people make a lot of effort to try and to make me a nice meal. So it's difficult being a monk, because you don't eat what you want to eat. You want to eat what people give you. A good example of that, the Thai custom, is that what they offer a monk, and what that monk eats, is what they would eat when they go up to heaven. So I learned that once when somebody gave me a durian. I don't mind durian, but I don't usually eat it these days. It's a bit too rich and stinky. But that particular day, they had a plate of durian. Oh, I don't fancy this today. I passed it down. And they complained. Again, to Ajahn Chakra. They said, Ajahn Brahm never ate my durian. That means I won't be able to eat durian myself when I go to heaven. And I love durian. That's really unfair and uncompassionate. That monk has stopped me getting durian when I go to heaven. So you can't win. So people like sausages, you've got to eat it so they can eat sausage in heaven. So anyway, you use the life cycle of a mango tree to describe what happens during death. Rebirth was refreshing. In contrast to some fundamentalists who hold that only fully lapped animals and selected anthropomorphic organisms are alive, you seem to hold a more scientific view that plants too are living beings with sentient streams of consciousness that will be able to sustain, to propagate, etc. Any comments? Okay, you know that sort of many animals are certainly alive and conscious as well. And I think every now and again, sort of, you get these wonderful sort of shows, documentaries about animals who can speak. You know, the one famous one is Alex the Parrot, who lives in St. Louis. Grey African parrot. How many of you have actually seen that documentary or documentaries of Alex the Parrot? Anyone? Really? Maybe it would be great if you can download it from the internet or somewhere. Or on YouTube. I'm sure he's got his own Facebook, Alex the Parrot. But anyhow, Alex the Parrot is a great African parrot, and these two psychologists who live in St. Louis, they decided, you know that parrots, they can imitate human voice, they can say pretty Polly or pieces of eight or whatever they say, and they wanted to see if they could use a technique which was developed on sort of backward children, you know, children who went to school but they couldn't really learn how to speak. The techniques were used on those children to use it on a parrot to see if it could teach it language. And it was amazingly successful. And they taught this parrot a whole language and taught it how to string the words together in cogent, intelligent sentences. And when I first saw that documentary, it was some of the most spookiest thing I've ever seen. Because that parrot, you close your eyes and it was speaking like a human being. And you opened your eyes and it was a parrot squawking. You know, it's opening its beak. And I was coming, yeah, I don't want to do this. Yeah, then I like a carrot, please. And it was actually talking, and people were talking to it, having a conversation with this parrot. And the convincer for me was when the parrot, when having this conversation, sort of shook its head and said, I'm bored, and stalked off. He had enough of the interview. So the parrot was actually showing not just the command of language, but of speech, but of emotions as well. And it was just so spooky because that just was just like a human being, but it was a parrot you were seeing there. And of course, also you've probably heard about Coco, who was a gorilla in New York Zoo, who they taught sign language to. And they caught him actually talking to himself, you know, using sign language, expressing words, you know, in the privacy. He thought he was not being watched, but they had a camera on him. And so, you know, these are intelligent beings who have language if you teach them it. So that really shows that there's not much difference between the human beings and the so-called animals. We are animals, actually. And there was one of the scientists, I think it was Dutch Linnaeus, he was a fellow who started the idea of species. He wanted to categorize the whole known fauna of the world, you know, the living beings, the animals and everything, into categories. And so he decided to have this idea of species. And being a good scientist, he wanted some way of categorizing every known animal into the species, you know, the size and, you know, what they look like, you know, whatever. And so he formed this idea of species, and he applied his rules to every living being, except when it came to human being. Because the way he'd worked it out, his scheme of things would put human beings in exactly the same species as chimpanzees and gorillas. As far as he was concerned, it was one and the same species. But he realized he would have no scientific credibility in the Western world if he equated, especially with the Christian Western world, if he equated human beings with gorillas and chimpanzees. So he made a special category, the primates for the gorillas and the chimpanzees, and Homo sapiens for human beings. And he sort of said afterwards that he broke his scientific rules to do that. It was the only way he could get his research published. But he knew that species-wise, we're exactly the same species as the gorillas and the chimpanzees. Which explains a lot about some people. There's not that much difference. As far as plants are concerned, Now, sometimes if you've done any biology at all, there are some plants you can't actually tell whether they're plant or animal. Things like Venus flytrap and stuff like that. Sometimes they look like an animal. There's other beings which are on the edge, and sometimes there's hardly any difference between some plants and some animals. Yeah.
Acacia trees will let other acacia trees know if they have been attacked by
giraffes. There you go. Acacia trees will sort of spread the word if they're being attacked.
Yes, and they produce the toxin in the top leaves.
Yeah.
And then for about, I think it's about 20 metres radius, all the acacia trees produce.
Okay, yeah. Some communication there. Yes, sometimes there's many things we don't know. Okay, maybe the last question because it's getting late. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you're useless. Oh, that's right, I've done that one already. One last question. We haven't gone through the questions today, so the other ones will have to wait till tomorrow. In the book of the Last Word by Ajahn Chah, the Last Word by Ajahn Chah, in relation to the why, the answer is there is nothing. Needless to say, I'm sold with a dirty rag cloth. Very big one. Cannot figure out on what is the why in that specific time. What has you beginning to figure out around the why? Whatever that means. But what it means, that's that story which I told, I think I wrote it in the Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond book. When Ajahn Chah, I just come out of a very deep meditation. And I went to go and find my teacher who was having a sauna. And when I went to find him, I was too late. He'd already had his sauna. But I was on the path, going in one direction. He was coming towards me with two laymen, two attendants. He was going back to his monastery. And as he passed me, he looked at me. He looked deeply into me. Not only a enlightened person can look like that. Holding your gaze and just reading your mind from top to bottom. So he saw I just had a very deep meditation. So he stopped me with his gaze. And asked me, Baba Wangso, why? He asked me the question, why? I stopped for a moment to contemplate. In the peace of my meditation, I came up with the answer, I don't know. I don't know. I'm only a young monk. And Ajahn Chah, seeing he was in front of a stupid disciple, he never sort of criticised you or told you off. He just laughed. Every time he did something stupid, he enjoyed it immensely. We created so much happiness for that monk for the stupid things we did. He'd always laugh at us. And you think it was great having these stupid Western monks around. He never had such a good time in his life laughing at us. So he just laughed. But then he screwed up his face again. And he looked at me. He said, Bama Wangsa, I'll tell you the answer. The answer to the question why. I was really interested. This is good because this was a great monk. He was the big question why. He was going to give me the answer, and the answer that these sort of monks give you, they must be very deep. So I was really hanging on the word and find out what is the answer to the question why. He said the answer to the question why is, there's a Thai lady is my me ally. There's nothing. That was the answer to the question why. There's nothing. And he looked at me. He said, Bama Wong sir, do you understand? I said, yes. He said, no, you don't. And he laughed and went away. It's a great exchange. Because it was a very deep teaching. You know, from one of the great masters of our age. Why? There is nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. So meditate some more. And see if you can understand the great emptiness. There's nothing there. That's the answer to the question why. What a great place to finish off this evening's question time. The biggest question of all has now been answered. So you have the answer. Now you've just got to figure out what it means. So happy figuring out. Or happy meditating. Or happy sleeping. You can always sleep on it. And we'll see you in the morning. 9:30 now. And please don't worry about these questions because we'll try and answer them tomorrow night. But please, because there's so many over here, If you answer the question, ask a question tonight, please have a question answered. Please don't write another one tomorrow. Otherwise, this box will get bigger and bigger and bigger. So you've got the biggest answer anyway. You know the answer to the question why is there's nothing. So what point is there any other questions? So anyway, just a few questions tomorrow from people who haven't asked one, haven't had theirs answered today. You can put some more questions in there. Okay, so now is the time for thinking about all the people who fed you today. Have you already deserved the food? Are you going to go to sleep and go to bed now when all those people worked so hard for you? Oh, you lazy, ungrateful lot. Are you a field of merit yet? Now go and have a rest, because you're just building up the energy for tomorrow morning. So don't feel too guilty. For those of you who've got some energy, because it's 3 or 4 days into the retreat now, so you should start to get some energy up. So if you do go to bed now and don't have a sleep, don't set your alarm. When you wake up in the morning, without an alarm, just get up and start meditating. See, it doesn't matter what time it is. And that way you're working with the body naturally. You're not thinking, sometimes it happens, it's 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock, I can't get up at 2 o'clock. Why not? Sometimes our thoughts, we have to sleep for 6 hours or 7 hours or 8 hours or whatever many hours you sleep. Don't think like that, because you're on a retreat now. It's a different situation. Just listen to your body. And the body will wake up when it's had enough, and then get up and meditate. And then if you've made a mistake, you can go to bed later on. That way you've been natural. Just because it's 9:30 doesn't mean you have to go to bed. Just because it's 2 o'clock doesn't mean you can't get up. So be natural and see what happens. Then you're becoming mindful of what your body's needs are. Sometimes it doesn't need that much. You haven't been doing very much the last 4 days. If you haven't been doing very much, you shouldn't need so much rest. See what happens. So, happy whatever you do. See you in the morning.